Welcome to Ellis Polyia. This is Aleko, and all glory is due to Christ. So this is going to be the scholarly argument for the resurrection of Christ in a nutshell. If you'd like to dive further into this topic, I would recommend that you glean from Dr. Gary Habermas, who famously wrote the minimal facts argument that scholars such as William Lane Craig, Lee Strobel, and Frank Turek, among many others, parrot to this day. So let's dive into it. If someone were to claim that Jesus rose from the dead due to natural causes, then that would indeed be absurd, because the claim that Christians make is that God rose Jesus from the dead. Anthony Flew, who converted to theism, or rather belief in God, from atheism, said that the resurrection of Christ is enormously more likely if God exists. Worth noting is that he converted to theism right after a very famous debate with Dr. Gary Habermas. Most historians and skeptics use methodological naturalism to attempt to refute the resurrection of Christ by saying that miraculous things don't happen. Therefore, the resurrection of Christ couldn't be possible. This is the same fallacy that the philosopher David Hume fell into, and it abnegates the merit of hundreds of thousands of stories of miraculous things happening around the world, not the least of which are the multitude of accounts which were recorded by Dr. Craig Keener in his famous book, Miracles, which our podcast book club read through and thoroughly enjoyed. The key elements that one should take away from these bullet points is that there is a mountain of qualitative data to prove that miracles do indeed happen, but unfortunately, they are not predictable and can't be recreated in a lab. Therefore, they are merely shunned by skeptics. That doesn't, however, mean that the world isn't replete with evidence for them, as I have seen in my personal life many times before, and many of the people surrounding me have witnessed as well. Okay, moving on to our next point. There are three R's that pertain to doing good history investigation. The first is relevant sources. The second, responsible method. And the third, restrained results. For number one, relevant sources, there are the New Testament writings as well as multiple secular sources from Romans, Jews, and Greeks alike. There are also the apostolic fathers who are a generation after the apostles, who had met with many of the eyewitnesses and written down in even more detail under the scrutiny of the public eye and people who had met these eyewitnesses. An example of this would be that Clement of Rome was a disciple of Peter, and Polycarp was a disciple of John. Both of them testified to the resurrection. So to distill the points, the narratives of the New Testament are considered ancient biographies, which are independently sourced from extremely credible eyewitnesses, as well as corroborated from multiple outsiders, including enemies of Christianity and those who were indifferent to the cause. The second R would be responsible method, which means assigning the greatest weight of testimony to early reports, eyewitness reports, enemy reports, as well as embarrassing reports, and especially those reports corroborated by others. Beyond any doubt among historical scholars, these walk hand in hand with the first R and are most certainly what we see with the evidence of the resurrection of the Christ. Finally, the last R is using restrained results, and this simply means not claiming any more than the evidence warrants. We're not going to suggest that we see anything else than what the data is displaying. And the data that we're going to utilize is also leveraged by academic atheists such as Bart Ehrman, who is arguably one of the most famous New Testament scholars in the atheist camp. Ehrman himself agrees with these 5 points that we brought up, and also says that there are a lot of things that are historically accurate from the Gospels, even if you do not agree with the message of Christianity. In short, we don't just need to believe in the resurrection on faith alone. The data points in that direction unequivocally. So here are 5 events which happened within the first 6 years of the crucifixion, which corroborate the resurrection of Christ, that nearly every scholar, atheist or believer, agrees to. The first is that Jesus died by Roman crucifixion. Crucifixion was a common form of execution used by the Romans at this time. All four gospel accounts claim Jesus died by crucifixion. Paul and the rest of the New Testament writers affirm it. Non-Christian sources, including Josephus, Tacitus, Lucian, Marabar, Serapion, and the Talmud, all support this as well. Examinations of the medical evidence described in the accounts of Jesus' death have led experts to conclude that surviving the crucifixion would not have been possible. Even the highly critical scholar John Dominic Crossan writes, quote, that Jesus was crucified is as sure as anything historical can ever be. The second event is the appearances of Christ. After his death, his disciples had experiences that they believed were appearances of the risen Jesus. Paul, the oral tradition of the early church, and the written works of the early church leaders all attest that the disciples believed that Jesus rose from the dead and appeared to them. In 1 Corinthians 15, 3-5, Paul quotes what scholars considered a creed from less than 5 years after Jesus' death. This was also asserted unanimously in the Gospels, written within 10 to 40 years after the crucifixion, and by extra-biblical sources such as Josephus, Tacitus, Clement, Ignatius, Polycarp, and Justin Martyr. The third event is the transformation. The disciples were transformed from fearful panic to boldly preaching his resurrection, and were willing to die for their beliefs. The entire New Testament and earliest chapters of church history testify to the transformation of the apostles, from a group of cowards who scattered, hid, and denied Christ, to bold proclaimers of his resurrection. Clement, Tacitus, Josephus, Marabar, Serapion, Pliny the Younger, Hegesippus, and Eusebius attest to the martyrdom of the disciples, and that they did not recant their faith. While we do have folks from other religions dying for things that they believed to be true, the difference in the case of the disciples is they died because of what they saw, and not merely what they were taught. The fourth event is the early creedal traditions. So, hearkening back to our reference of 1 Corinthians chapter 15, verses 3 through 5, where we saw an early creedal tradition dated to within 5 years of the resurrection of Christ, it's worth noting that the earliest Christology is the highest Christology. One common rebuttal toward Christianity is that Christ's nature as the divine Son of God was a fabrication, or rather, was made up, and that Jesus, the historical figure, was a man who never claimed anything lofty about himself, never claimed to be God, and never claimed to be divine. But when we read the epistles and the Gospels, we note that Christ has very high titles, such as Lord and the Son of Man, a messianic title, within only a few years of his resurrection by people who were risking death to agree with this sentiment. And they were writing and teaching these things among other people who had witnessed Christ, so that a chance of fabrication was little, and their motivation must have been something significant. For this exact message, most of the disciples were whipped and beaten to death over the course of several decades, as were many other new converts. So the question remains, what did they see? So, backtracking to the discussion of creedal traditions, worth noting is that many people of antiquity could not write or read. So a memorization technique which was passed down from the ages was remembering creeds that often had some type of rhyming pattern. Those creeds show up in the earliest letters of Paul dated to within 1 to 5 years of the crucifixion. The creedal traditions, or rather homologia as they were known in Greek, always included three things. 1. His deity. 2. How he died. And 3. His resurrection. The fifth event is the conversion of James, Jesus' unbelieving brother. Both Peter the Apostle, through the book of Mark, and in the book of John, note that James was not a believer, even though he was a blood brother of Christ. In fact, his blood brothers even thought Christ was crazy and therefore an embarrassment to their family during the time of the Gospels. This is even highlighted by the fact that Jesus gives his mother to John when he was dying on the cross, instead of one of his blood brothers. Then somehow, between the crucifixion and the book of Acts, which was merely 50 days, there was a colossal transformation, and James was a believer, which is confirmed not only by the writers of the scripture, but also by outside historians as well, such as Hegesippus. Finally, I'll throw in a bonus sixth event. and that is, of course, Paul's conversion. Paul was a former persecutor of Christians, and he was converted by what he believes was an appearance of the risen Jesus. In his letters to the churches in Corinth, Galatia, and Philippi, all accepted by critical scholars, Paul writes of his conversion from persecutor of Christians to proclaimer of Jesus' resurrection, willing to suffer continuously for the gospel to the point of death. These facts were documented by Luke, Clement, Polycarp, Tertullian, Dionysius, and Origen. All right, well, there you have it, folks. The scholarly argument for the resurrection of Jesus Christ in a nutshell. Again, I highly recommend you look into the work of Dr. Gary Habermas. He has a lot of great stuff in podcast format and on YouTube. He is the one who originated what is known as the minimal facts argument, which was what you just heard in a nutshell. I would also recommend you look up William Lane Craig, Lee Strobel, Frank Turek, who also discuss these minimal facts and have their own versions of them. I think that they are fantastic scholars to glean from as well. God bless. And as we would say in Greek, Christos Anesti, Christ is risen.